This message, titled Three Responses to Jesus, from Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 through 12, was preached at Winchester Reformed Presbyterian Church in Winchester, Kansas. For more information, visit us at winchesterrp.com. Brothers and sisters, the second chapter here of the Gospel of Matthew, which is one of only two places in the New Testament where we really have information given us concerning the infancy of Jesus, the Gospel of Luke being the only other gospel that deals with the birth of Christ. This second chapter of Matthew's gospel is, for all intents and purposes, it's a roller coaster. And I say it's a roller coaster this morning because, on the one hand, it contains one of the highest points of the life of Jesus prior to his resurrection. Together, perhaps, with the baptism of Jesus and later the transfiguration of Jesus on the mountaintop, the visit of the Magi from the East, the visit of those whom are called here the wise men, is one of the most significantly high points of the life of Jesus Christ. On the other hand, this chapter also contains one of the lowest points of Jesus' life prior to his own crucifixion and death, as the infants of Bethlehem become the very first to die for the sake of the name of Jesus Christ. And what a tremendously low point that is, even as Christ the child is spared when the infants of Bethlehem are called by the providence of God to spill their blood for the sake of Jesus Christ. And so Matthew 2 is a roller coaster. And between these two points, between that high point and that low point, the evangelist continues to give to us his account of the gospel, his account of the good news of Jesus Christ. But we need to keep in mind, as we have tried to do in weeks past and will continue to do, that as Matthew retells this narrative, as he recounts for us the real history of the birth of Jesus Christ, And later, filling out more of the details of his life and ministry, we need to ever keep in mind that Matthew is not simply teaching us a history lesson the way in which most of us learn and study history. You and I can sit down with a history book, a textbook, and intellectually we can gather all kinds of interesting information about people and places and events and times and seasons. And yet we can get up from our chair unchanged in our lives, having tucked away intellectual knowledge that really requires nothing of us. And if we approach the Gospel of Matthew in that way, we miss the whole point of the evangelist. We miss the whole point of the evangel that he is communicating. Because what Matthew is doing in this prologue, and what not only Matthew, but as we will see if the Lord is willing in time, what Jesus himself does throughout the entirety of his ministry, brothers and sisters, what Matthew is doing here is he is reminding us that every person who hears the news of Christ responds in a particular way. It is impossible to hear the news of Jesus and not have a particular response. And Matthew, as he began to do in the first chapter and continues to do here, Matthew pushes against my heart and your heart, putting the question forward, what will be your response to the news of Jesus Christ? How will you respond to the one who is the Christ? And in these first 12 verses of chapter 2, Matthew really contrasts for us. Well, you might say he contrasts in the first place the Magi, the wise men, and what their response is to the news of Jesus Christ. And he contrasts that with what we will be looking at this morning, and that is three other responses that are given to the news of Jesus. The response of Herod, the response of all of Jerusalem, and the response of the ones who are the teachers, the chief priests, and the scribes. And this morning I want, as we can, to come to each of these three responses that Matthew is contrasting to the response of the wise men. I want you to notice in this then first, I want you to notice Herod's response. Herod's response to the news of Jesus Christ. Now again, in verse 1, we begin to have the scene set for us, don't we? Now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem. Matthew does not indicate how much time has passed since Jesus was born in Bethlehem. There are many people who, for fictioned reasons, imagine that the events of this chapter happened perhaps on the exact same night that Jesus was born. Very unlikely. It does seem to indicate time has passed, perhaps even 2 years has passed since the birth of Jesus Christ. But here's what we're told in verse 1. Now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king. Herod the king. Now without getting into all of the socio-political nuances of the day and age in which Christ was born, You might know the simple fact that at this point in history, Israel is under Roman rule. Maybe you remember in Luke's gospel, in Luke chapter 2, those words that many of us are familiar with because we've heard them and we've read them 1,000 times. Luke chapter 2, verse 1, that Caesar Augustus issued a decree to the whole world that people were to go and to be registered in their birthplace. And of course, simply naming that in Luke's gospel, Caesar Augustus, Caesar is emperor. Augustus is the Roman emperor. And he has political power over Israel. And as the Roman emperor, Augustus actually appointed different kings in different provinces. And what we are told here in verse 1 is that in the province of Judea, Herod is king. Herod has been set up by Caesar Augustus to be the king in Judea. And so he is sitting on the throne. So as we're introduced to this in the first verse, of course, the drama somewhat begins to build, doesn't it? In verse 1, now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? Well, how do you think Herod's going to respond to that question? Where is he? Where is the one who is born king of the Jews? Of course, Herod's not going to respond to that question with an ambitious excitement. And in fact, he doesn't. The question is asked there in verse 2, where is he who is born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. And then in verse 3, when Herod the king heard this, he was troubled. He was troubled. The word there used for troubled is just, we can fill it in with synonyms, can't we? Herod was disturbed. Maybe more emotive and more colorfully, Herod was, for all intents and purposes, Herod was terrified. He hears the news that the Christ has been born, the one who is the King of the Jews, and Herod is terrified. And of course, it doesn't take much of an imagination, does it, to understand obviously why Herod is terrified. Why it is that Herod is disturbed and troubled by this news. He's troubled by it because the announcement is, where's the one who's the King of the Jews? This King of the Jews can only be a rival king. He can only be a rival king. Since the days, if you remember your Old Testament history, since the days of the Babylonian captivity of the Old Testament, for centuries, the Davidic line has seemed, by all appearances and human measurement, to have come to an end. There is no king in Israel. And in that time, since that captivity, Rome has come in, they have conquered Israel, and Herod has been established as king, and Herod knows that the news that there is the King of the Jews, that this king will threaten his reign. He will threaten his rule. He will threaten the royal prerogatives. Maybe to reduce Herod's response to a simple word, his troublement is caused by what? It's caused by selfishness. A self-centeredness, because, brothers and sisters, Herod knows what the title king means. He knows that in the birth of another king, Herod cannot even be a vice. He cannot be a co-regent. There is no sharing of thrones among kings, and Herod wants his throne. And so he's threatened. And because he is threatened, he is terrified at the thought that he will lose his power and he will lose control. He likes to be in control. And brothers and sisters, we would be remiss if we did not see something, you might say, of a parable of the human heart in the response of Herod. Herod's response reveals, brothers and sisters, it is a reflection of what in our sin is naturally true, not simply of Herod, but of you and me and sinners who go on in their sin. The Apostle Paul in 2 Timothy chapter 3, a well-known passage, Paul warns Timothy, this young pastor, about what the world around him is going to be like. And Paul says to Timothy, he says, Timothy, look, in these last days, in all the days between the resurrection of Christ and his coming again, Paul says, Timothy, you need to understand how these last days are going to be characterized. And one of the very first things that Paul tells Timothy there in 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 2, how will these evil days be characterized? They will be characterized by people, Paul says, who are lovers of self. They love themselves. They're selfish. They're self-centered. They love themselves. Elsewhere, Paul speaks in 2 Corinthians chapter 5 of those who live for themselves. Those who live for themselves, as contrasted with those who live for Jesus Christ. What Paul is saying, and we need to understand this, brothers and sisters, oh, how we need to understand this, because the root of every sin exists in our hearts. Paul is saying there is a profound selfishness in every heart. And it is a selfishness, it is a self-centeredness that says, I will be king. I will be king. I will answer to no one. I will answer
to nothing. And this is what every single one of us is prone to do, to build and to fortify our pitiful little kingdom of self, where me, myself, and I sit on the throne of my life. No one will tell me what to do. No one will tell me how to do it. No one will tell me why I need to do it. I want to be king. And to be blunt this morning, brothers and sisters, Jesus threatens that. Jesus threatens my selfishness. Jesus threatens your selfishness. Jesus threatens our self-entitlement, brothers and sisters, as surely as Herod's kingdom was threatened. Jesus threatens the little kingdom of self that you and I have built. And he confronts it. He confronts it by his word. He confronts it by his gospel. He confronts it by his person. He confronts it by his titles. He is king. And there's no sharing the throne with Jesus. Paul in Romans chapter 10. In Romans chapter 10, Paul speaks of the gospel being made known to the corners of the earth. And Paul in Romans 10 verse 9 says, and many of you know this verse by heart, if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. If you confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord, he's master. If you confess with your mouth, Jesus is king, and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. And the tragedy of our fallenness and the tragedy of our inherent selfishness, brothers and sisters, is that countless people are unwilling to confess Christ as king. Because the kingship and the reign of Jesus Christ can only mean the end of my reign of my life. Jesus in Matthew chapter 16 reminds his disciples what it is to follow him. In Matthew 16, if you would come after me, deny yourself. Deny yourself and pick up your cross and follow me. And it is Herod's inherent selfishness, this being threatened by a rival king, that leaves him trembling and troubled in his heart. So that's Herod's response. But Herod's is not the only response that's going to be contrasted here with the response of the Magi. Another response contrasted to the wise men is Jerusalem's response. Jerusalem's. So again, Matthew, in telling us of the gospel of Christ, Matthew tells us that Jesus is born in Bethlehem, Herod's king. These wise men from the east, they come, and they come to where? They come to Jerusalem. They come to the city of the king. They come to Jerusalem, and the picture that we actually get in verse 2 is that these wise men did not come under the guise of darkness. They did not come furtively and secretly, just kind of tiptoeing about. They come to Jerusalem, and they begin saying, they begin asking, where is he? Where's the one that is born king of the Jews? Far and wide, the picture is that they're spreading abroad this question, where is the one who is the Christ? And in verse 3, when the news finally reaches Herod, he's troubled, but then notice what Matthew adds in verse 3. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all of Jerusalem with him. All of Jerusalem. All of Jerusalem is troubled by the news. All of Jerusalem is disturbed. All of Jerusalem, in their own way, are terrified at the news of the one who is king of the Jews. And we have to ask the question, why? Why on earth is Jerusalem, all of Jerusalem, as troubled as Herod by the news of Christ? Maybe you know, but there's that little Old Testament book, Lamentations. Lamentations was written by Jeremiah the prophet. Jeremiah, you may know, who's nicknamed the Weeping Prophet, largely in part for the book of Lamentation. And the book of Lamentations is what? It's five laments. Five laments. And what is Jeremiah lamenting there in the book of Lamentations, and in his prophetic role as the voice and the representative of the people? Do you remember what Jeremiah is lamenting? Jeremiah is lamenting the destruction of Jerusalem. That the Babylonians have come, and they have come in great number, and they have razed the city. They have left it a heap of rubble. And Jeremiah, so poetically, so emphatically, is there any sorrow, is there any grief like my grief? My eyes run down with tears because this people cannot even be looked upon. And there's an interesting part in Jeremiah's fourth lament, Lamentations chapter 4, where Jeremiah, in particular, he laments what happened to the king? What happened to the one who at that time was sitting on Israel's throne, and Babylon comes and they take the king off his throne? And Jeremiah in Lamentations 4, verse 20, weepingly says of that king, he says, "The breath of our nostrils, the Lord's anointed, has been taken." That's emphatic. The breath of our nostrils. Jeremiah is saying this anointed of the Lord, the one who is king, he is our very life. The very life of this nation. The Lord's anointed has been taken from us. We longed, he says, something to the effect, we longed to live under his shadow, and he has now been taken. The one who is our very life. And hundreds of years later, the Magi come into this same city. It's been rebuilt and reestablished. And after hundreds of years, they ask the question, where's the King of the Jews? Where's the one who is to be to Israel the very breath of their nostrils? Jerusalem should be rejoicing. Jerusalem should be glad. Jerusalem should be happy. Jerusalem should be welcoming. This news of the one who is the king. Maybe you remember in Mary's response of praise in Luke chapter 2. Mary gets it. Mary perceives rightly in Luke as she sings her praise. He has shown strength with his arm, and he has scattered the proud in their thoughts, and he has brought down mighty thrones, because he is the glory of Israel. And you might think here in Matthew 2, Jerusalem would imbibe something of that. But rather we read that all of Jerusalem, together with Herod, are troubled. The question is why? Why? And the answer is this, brothers and sisters. Let me state it, and I'll show it to you from the scriptures. But the answer, very simply, is this: all of Jerusalem is troubled because all of Jerusalem has compromised. They're compromised. You know, we think of compromise, don't we? Compromise means, it means conceding, means yielding. Sometimes compromise means accommodating another position. Sometimes compromise is very necessary. You don't get far in the marital relationship without compromise. There are very few hard and fast lines that you draw in the marital relationship and say, I'm not budging and I'm not compromising. There are places in our lives, in a very godly way, we have to compromise. But biblically speaking, when we think of compromise, we rightly also understand that there are hard and fast lines. And we don't shrink back, and we don't yield, and we don't concede ground, and we stand fast. We stand fast with boldness and courage, and to compromise on that is a tremendous sin. And Jerusalem has compromised in that sense. To express it this way this morning, as wicked and as heavy-handed and as morally bankrupt as Herod is, Jerusalem prefers life under his rule than life under the rule of Messiah. They're completely compromised. You know, we get pictures of this throughout the Gospels. In John chapter 11, Jesus is teaching. And we read that as he's teaching, there are some, a few, who believe. But then there's a whole other group of Jews, we are told, who don't believe. And they leave Jesus, they leave his teaching, and they go and they begin to talk to others, and they begin to conspire, and they begin to get worried. They ask the question in John 11:48. They ask the question, well, what should we do? What should we do about this Jesus? And they go on to say, here's what John says in John 11:48. They go on as they are talking to themselves. They ask this question, what should we do about Jesus? And then they say this, if we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And then the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. Do you hear what they're saying? If we let him continue to teach, if we let him continue to perform the miracles that he is performing, everybody's going to believe in him. And if everybody believes in him, the Romans are going to come in and they're going to take what they've given us. They're going to take our place. They're going to take our nation. And what they're saying in that moment, you hear it, don't you? What they are saying is they are more complacent and more content with what the Roman Empire gives them than what is offered to them in Jesus the Christ. And they are fearful that the Roman Empire will take what it has given. Maybe you remember in John chapter 19, Pilate is vacillating there on the eve of Christ's crucifixion. What do we do with him? What do we do with him? And you remember in John 19, Pilate puts the question to the people. What should we do about the Christ? Should he be released? And John there in John chapter 19, verse 12, writes these words, but the Jews cried out, if you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. If you release this man, you're not Caesar's friend. They were so bent on friendship and alliance with Caesar. They, if I can put it this way this morning, they so wanted the crumbs from Caesar's table that they would consign Christ to Calvary's hill. They are a completely compromised people. They're compromised. They prefer the small privileges given by Rome to what Christ himself would offer. And isn't this a pattern, isn't it? You remember in Exodus? You remember the way Exodus begins? Exodus begins by telling us that Jehovah heard the groaning of his people. In slavery and in bondage in Egypt, he hears their groaning. And how does Jehovah respond? He delivers them. He brings them up out of the land of Egypt, out of the household of slavery and bondage. He delivers them, and almost no sooner than that fickle people are delivered and they compromise. It was better in Egypt. Who do you think you are, Moses, bringing us up? In Egypt, at least our bellies were filled with food. They pined after the scraps of Egypt while compromising on the better promises that God would give them. And so John chapter 1, verse 11, he came into the world and the world did not receive him. He came to his own and his own knew him not. Luke chapter 19, verse 14. We do not want this man to reign over us. And here, Jerusalem prefers Herod over Christ. And of course, we see the insanity of that. They prefer Herod, who would sacrifice their children, to the one who is the Christ. They're compromised because they're comfortable. And it is again, brothers and sisters, it is a parable that reveals our hearts. Brothers and sisters, there is perhaps no greater strategy that Satan is employing in our lives and in our world today than to get us to be comfortable in this world. Because Satan knows, brothers and sisters, the enemy of our soul knows that for the scraps that come from the table of this world, people will compromise. People will compromise. Satan knows that to lull men and women and children into a state of comfort makes them very pliable to be compromisers, to sell out for the comfort and the pleasures and the offerings of this world and this society and this culture for a moment to fit in with a godless world. And how many would prefer that over kingship, the kingship and allegiance to Jesus? Jesus tells us in Matthew 10 what the stakes are. Jesus says, don't think for a moment that I have come to bring peace. I have come to bring division. And into our overly comfortable lives, Jesus says, I have brought a sword. And if you do not love me more than you love parents, siblings, children, you're not worthy of me. You're not worthy if you're a compromiser. And Jerusalem is compromised. And then finally, briefly this morning, there's another response that is contrasted with the wise men. And it's the response of the teachers. The teachers. Herod and all of Jerusalem are troubled. And we read then in verse 4 that Herod, we read, and assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. They told him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for so it is written by the prophet, And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. Herod gathers the priests and the scribes, those of the tribe of Levi, who once were such distinguished men. And he says, hey, chief priests and scribes, those of you, and right, these are the people in Israel. They're the experts. They're the interpreters of the law. The scribes wrote the law day and night. They transcribed the law of Moses and other portions of Scripture. They're the ones, for all intents and purposes, that had PhDs in this day and age. Herod assembles the religious teachers and he says, hey, where's the Christ to be born? Everybody has heard that the King of the Jews is born. Everybody hears that the Christ is here. So where is he to be born? And the chief priests and the scribes, they live up to their name. They are able to tell him exactly from the scriptures where it is that the Christ is going to be born. Herod, your answer is Bethlehem. Bethlehem is where the Christ is going to be born. And then what do these teachers do? What do they do? They do nothing. They do nothing. They do nothing. The wise men from the east, as we will see, Lord willing, next week, are compelled to go to Bethlehem and search out the Christ. But the teachers of the law, those with the most knowledge of the scriptures, do nothing. And if Herod's response is one of selfishness and Jerusalem's response is one of compromise, the response of these teachers is that of total indifference. The scriptures say, we know what the scriptures say. We know, and we simply don't care. It is irrelevant, and it is to no purpose to us to go to Bethlehem to find the Christ. You know, these are those whom the scriptures warn us of, right? The scriptures warn us of this indifferent response. People who go on learning, and it's all it is to them, is learning. Jesus, who later in this very gospel in Matthew 13 will say, you know, there will be those who indeed hear, but they will never understand. They will see, but they will never perceive because their hearts have grown dull. Their hearts have grown dull. These are men who know the scriptures, and their hearts are dull. And they're completely indifferent to the news of Jesus Christ. Do you remember in John's Apocalypse, as he's given the warnings to the seven churches, probably the one most of us are familiar with is the warning that is given to the church in Laodicea. Why? Because the one who walks among the lampstands says to them, you are neither hot nor are you cold. You are lukewarm, and I will spit you out of my mouth. Jesus is saying, you're altogether useless. I have no use for indifferent people. I have no use for the lukewarm. And that's how the teachers respond, because their hearts are dull. Their hearts are dull. Brothers and sisters, to bring this to a conclusion, here's what Matthew is doing. Matthew's drawing a line in the sand. And Matthew is saying there are only one of two responses to Jesus Christ. There is the response, again, Lord willing, we'll see it next week. There is the response of the Magi. And on the other side of the line, doesn't matter who you are, it doesn't matter where you are. on the other side of the line, whether it's for selfishness, whether it's for being compromised, whether it's for indifference, you're on the other side of the line. And Matthew is preparing us, again, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but we have to come to the pages of this gospel in this way. Matthew is saying, do not. As we come to the news of Jesus who is the Christ, do not hear this. Do not hear all that Matthew will say in the next 26 chapters with indifference and with a dull heart. Do not come to this gospel where Jesus himself will throw the gauntlet down, where Jesus will draw the lines in the sand. You are either for me or you are against me. Do not compromise. And do not come to this gospel with some inflated, self-entitled selfishness that says to the one who is the King of Kings, I don't want you to rule over me. Matthew is saying, turn the pages of this evangel. Turn the pages of this gospel witness and see the King for who he is. See him for who he is. Let's pray.